get to know you. As is apparent, or apparently we know, this course is called Relativity. I've interpreted the course as a course in general relativity, or actually, given that we only have 3 weeks, it's an introduction to general relativity. In fact, I believe that several of you have already had an introduction to general relativity. Could you put your hands up? Oh my gosh. That's okay. That's very good. John, have you had an introduction to general relativity? No. Oh dear. Okay. Well, this is going to add some extra texture to this bold experiment. I would hate that all of you go through this and not learn anything new. So perhaps we can get together tomorrow at lunch and discuss what the possibilities are to ensure that everybody is learning something in this course. What I had intended, though, was just an introduction to general relativity. That's certainly needed as part of your foundation in learning about theoretical physics. And what you'll learn, or what we'll find, is that general relativity provides us with a beautiful geometric framework with which to describe gravitational forces. It's a framework that's undergone intense scrutiny. It's survived accurate experimental tests. And that's really the reason that you're learning about it here. But those tests and the physics that it describes is really the physics of the longest scales in physics that we work with. It's simply a reflection of the fact that gravity becomes important when we're talking about planets, stars, galaxies, or in fact, the entire universe as a whole. Places where you'll find general relativity in subsequent courses or in different areas of physics. Cosmology, of course, comes to mind first of all. Cosmology, although you're going to get a theoretical introduction to cosmology, hopefully what you'll learn is that at least for the past decade, cosmology has been an observational science, and general relativity or calculations with general relativity are essential to understanding those observations. In particular, there are new tests coming online for cosmological observations or predictions involving something known as gravitational lensing. Another exciting discovery of the past, well, maybe decade, perhaps even longer, is that at the center of every galaxy, we'll find a black hole. It's amusing that until very recently, even though we knew that there were black holes out there, in many calculations that astrophysicists made, basically what they did is they treated a black hole as something that had a Newtonian potential, but if something got too close to it, it disappeared off their grid. But now we're actually entering an era of astrophysics or astronomy where the observations are so precise or precise enough that they have to actually do the calculations in general relativity. We're also hopefully entering a new era in astronomy or in gravitational wave astronomy, which will open a new window on astrophysics or on the universe. And then, of course, at a more abstract level, general relativity plays a role in it calls for an understanding of quantum gravity. And so people doing loop quantum gravity or quantum gravity as a whole or string theory are using the tools of general relativity all the time. I myself, for instance, am trying to understand something known as the quark gluon plasma. That doesn't sound like general relativity, but it turns out that the insights I can bring to this new phase of nuclear matter, which is being studied at an experiment in Brookhaven known as RIC, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, it'll be studied hopefully when they turn on the LHC. for the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. But the reason I can bring some insight into this new phase of matter is because I can work with black holes. I can work with general relativity, albeit it's a form or a theory of general relativity, it turns out, in 5 or perhaps 10 dimensions. One of the remarkable things we'll learn about general relativity when we get to black holes is that it's a theory that predicts its own demise. When we get inside the black holes, we'll run into singularities. The equations break down. This isn't something that can be avoided. It's not like there's a problem over there and we'll just ignore it. It's something that anything falling into the black hole runs into this singularity. And to carry physics forward, we need a new set of equations. We need a better physical framework to describe. So that's just a little bit of a flavor for what that title means or where we're going, this bold new adventure. But before we go or start our adventure, there's some logistics. So first of all, you all have this beautiful book. I can see some of you brought it to class. Marvelous. It's a great book. Read it. There are going to be lots of insights, lots of perspectives that you won't see in the lectures that are given in the book. The book is also going to be a source for many problems. We have tutorials. We have homework assignments or homework problems. So in the afternoon, you'll be working on various problems. Those problems are going to be found on the course webpage on the wiki. There's a problem set that's been put up there this morning, and I'll be putting up somewhere between 6 and 10 problems every day. Do I expect you to do all of the problems? Well, if you can, do them all. If you find that they're boring and you're not learning anything from these problems, then there's no obligation to do them. However, we have to assess your progress in some way, and so what you'll find on the assignments is that probably about one problem per day I'm going to ask you to do and hand in at some point to be graded, just so that we can see how everybody's doing, that we're not, or that I'm not failing to teach you and leaving you behind or whatever. Typically, you'll be handing something in on a Monday or a Thursday. This week, I decided that I took the liberty of telling, of making the problem sets due on Tuesday, and you can hand those in at the beginning of the tutorials on Tuesdays. So that is the logistics, but I'll pause. Are there any questions? No questions. Ugh. We're going to have to do better than that. Okay. So we're about to start off on a bold new adventure. However, to start that bold new adventure, I have to meet you on common ground. And so rather than talking about general relativity today, I'm going to be reviewing a couple of topics. So we will start, actually, with classical mechanics. So what do we have in classical mechanics? Basically, we can summarize it with Newton's second law, F equals ma. Or for a particle in a potential, what that formula means is, well, I'll start with this side, m times the second derivative equals the gradient of our potential. I'm going to run out of blackboard space real quick, I can tell. So that's the simplest version of classical mechanics. That's what you probably learned in first year. We can soup this up, though, with a framework involving Lagrangians and something known as Hamilton's principle. And since you don't have any questions, I will ask the question and ask you, what is Hamilton's principle? Yes, just a second. It would be, I give up. Which, can you tell me your name?
Your name is?
Dennis. Yes.
Where are you?
Yeah, okay, we'll worry about that later. Anyway, what is Hamilton's principle?
Assuming it's about Hamiltonian dynamics, it's the idea that, oh goodness, you should, you know, if you want to describe dynamics, you take your configuration space, that's a manifold. You take the engine manifolds, and then all your dynamics are described on that.
That's one version. Let's see what we get over here.
The dynamics of the particle is such that the action is stationary.
Okay, that's something that's closer to, or it's not the precise words that I was going to write here, but that's essentially what I wanted to say. Namely that when the system, when I have a physical system and moving from one configuration to the next, in some fixed time interval, the trajectory that the system follows is the path that extremizes the action. So that's essentially what we're told here. So we can imagine that we have some, well, the simplest case is some particle. So at our initial time, it's sitting, say, at some position here, x naught. There are lots of different ways that I can get from one point to the other, but the path that the system chooses is the one that extremizes the action. What do I mean by the action? Well, I write down a Lagrangian that depends on coordinates and coordinate velocities. It's defined as basically the kinetic energy minus the potential energy. My action is simply the integral over my integral.
And I'm supposed to take the variation. So I vary the action, which means that I'm going to vary the Lagrangian and set the result to zero. Since I've got a whole bunch of different parameters here describing different possible paths, what this amounts to more explicitly is a sum over the different indices I, where I can vary, or I can essentially take the derivative with respect to qi, delta qi, and then I'm going to vary with respect to the velocities as well. Because I'm running out of space, I apologize, but what I do is I integrate by parts. Put the time derivative here. There's also a boundary term that I run into, but that boundary term will have a delta qi. But what I said is that in my problem, I fix the boundary conditions at the initial and the final time. So that boundary term disappears. And then the conclusion is that in order that this variation be equal to zero, for arbitrary variations delta qi, then I must have a set of equations of motion that say that zero is
Well, there's different ways to write it. DDT, delta L. QI dot equals. And delta Q. So those are my Lagrangian equations of motion that ensure that this, well, that this principle is satisfied, or that this action, this integral, is extremal. Okay. Oh, well, okay, I'll let him play with that. So implicitly here, I described a Lagrangian that had quite in general, this could be quite complex. I didn't specify what the QIs were or what the index I ran over. Implicitly here, when I'm drawing something with Xs and drawing particles in space, or a particle moving in space, I'm just thinking of a simple case where the kinetic energy is just 1/2 the velocity squared, and then minus some potential that depends on the position. And if we go through this process with that Lagrangian, what I'll do is I'll recover Newton's law as I wrote it for the chess particle. And at this point, what I'd like to do is make an aside. And talk about this messy equation that I wrote on the board. The more stuff I write on the board, the messier it gets. A convenient convention that we're going to be using over and over in this course is a summation convention, which is that if I write an equation like this and I see a particular index repeated twice, that implicitly I'm going to be talking about a situation where I'm summing over all of the values of that index. And so what that means is that this is redundant if I understand when I look at that that there's an implicit summation. So repeated indices are summed over. Another rule of good housekeeping, or good, well, what did I call it? Yeah, I call it good housekeeping, good equation keeping. Is that when I write a coordinate such as x, or a component of a coordinate xi, that the index is always upstairs. That's not really too important right here. In classical mechanics, you'll find that your equations have indices upstairs and downstairs, and they get mixed. In general relativity, later on in the course, or even in special relativity, it's going to be very important that we keep track of whether indices are upstairs and downstairs. The paired indices will always be raised and lowered, essentially as I see it here. This is a raised index. This is raised, but it's in the denominator, or in the denominator, and so it counts as a downstairs index. That's just going to make life easier for us. And so it's a good rule to get into a habit of. Given this equation, one of the
I talked about Hamilton's principle, and one of the natural things that you learned about is Hamiltonians, and there was an instinct to start talking about Hamiltonian dynamics or a Hamiltonian formulation of this problem. And one of the things that we run into naturally are the generalized momenta, which just means this component or this object here, that and so in this particular problem, that takes the familiar form that all that is the mass times the velocity. So this is the case we're familiar with in Physics 101. This is the generalized case that we write down there. But in particular then, if L is independent of one or some QI. What that means is on this side of the equation, we're going to get zero. And so our equation is that d by dt of the generalized momentum is zero. And so what that means is that the momentum is conserved. So in the general case, the momentum is not conserved because there's a potential or there's a force that acts on the particle. But let's say I just set u equal to zero, I had a free particle, then what that would be saying is that all of the momenta are conserved. But in general, say, if the potential only did not depend, say, on x, then the x component of momentum is conserved. So this is another useful idea that we'll touch on later in the course. In fact, there's one more conserved quantity in general. Well, a comment is that these are called cyclic coordinates. There is a branch of classical mechanics where we work hard and we try and turn all of the coordinates into cyclic coordinates or discover as many conserved momenta as possible. All I would say is that, you know, coordinates, well, one of the themes of this course is that coordinates are our friends. We should make the choice of coordinates in any particular problem that makes the problem as simple as possible. And so we should find a coordinate system or arrange our coordinate system in a way to produce as many conserved quantities or conserved momenta as possible. The other constant of motion, as well as momenta, that you're, of course, very familiar with is energy. And this occurs in the case when my Lagrangian is independent of time. So if L has no explicit time dependence. So for example, here I've got a potential. It could be some polynomial in x. Those coefficients in that polynomial could, in general, be functions of time. Usually we're not interested in, well, typically, in the courses you've taken, I'm sure you're not interested or you haven't touched on problems like that. And so the energy is conserved. So there's no so those are problems without an explicit time dependence, and the energy is conserved. So there are different ways of writing the energy. Typically, we just think of it as the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. Or if we're starting with our Lagrangian, the formal way to do it is
make the Legendre transformation. Or consider this quantity here. Again, in this simple case, it's just 1/2 and x dot squared plus u, or I could write it as p squared over 2m plus u. And this is, of course, a constant in our system. Sure. That's right, you should.
That's right. And so that was what gave rise to the comment that in classical mechanics, it's not
a terribly important rule to follow because things get mixed. But as I'm sure you know, that when we get to general, or when we get to special relativity, you will keep track of that index because there'll be another object in the equation. I mean, the quote unquote, well, no, I'm not going to dwell on it here. Yeah. So in one lecture, it'll become important. It's not that important now, but I thought I'd mention it now. However, basically, that's everything that I wanted to tell you about classical mechanics. That's everything, I think, well, that touches on all of the ideas that we're going to use in this course. As many of you may know, we're actually in this course not really going to get beyond the free particle in the description of motions in general relativity. And so this, in some sense, is even more sophisticated, but in some senses, as Callum was describing, not sophisticated enough to describe the situations that we'll be interested in. So let me pause there. Are there any other questions about classical mechanics?
Yes. It's not really relevant, but it's something I've wondered. How do you, so, canonically, like, you split Lagrangian up into kinetic and potential energy just because you're familiar with those things from classical, from Newtonian mechanics.
Yeah.
But is there sort of, like, do those things actually mean something, or are they, do we just, like, use those symbols because it helps us write down Lagrangians by familiarity? Like, if I gave you an arbitrary Lagrangian in the physical system, could you look at it and say, these are the potential terms and these are the kinetic?
No. In classical mechanics, you know, basically this is telling me something about the motion of the particle, and this is assuming that there's some potential that describes the external forces. But it's a good place to ask. So this is a very
important, framework. Well, Hamiltonians, but for us Lagrangians. But let me ask you, is that all of the classical mechanics that you've learned in your courses? Does that describe every problem that you've studied? Yeah.
Well, what about forces that can't be described with potential?
There you go. That's the... There are a lot of forces. I mean, you didn't run into Lagrangians until your second course. Implicitly here, we're talking about conservative forces. By definition, a conservative force is one that's described by some potential. There are a lot of forces that we know about, or that we... fundamental forces, like I'm going to talk about gravity in a moment, is a conservative force. There's a potential associated with that. We run into other forces, for example, friction. If I slide your book across the desk, it looks like a free particle, but it doesn't behave like a free particle in the equations of the board because there's friction. That frictional force can't be described in this framework because there's no potential. And so I'm sure you, for example, you spend an awful lot of time studying damped force harmonic oscillators. But that damping force was not something that, or you studied that probably before you got the Lagrangian, because that damping force wasn't something that was going to fit in spring. Sorry, did you hear?
Yeah.
Can you use, I might have learned this before, but can't remember. Can you use this framework to describe something without a scalar potential, but that does have a vector potential? And obviously, I guess I'm thinking of magnetism there, but.
So the answer is yes, and you'll get to practice that on the problems. Well, in the, I think it was a homework problem this afternoon.
Ah, okay.
But, well, electromagnetism is in particular an interesting thing.
So you can see why friction forces wouldn't fit into Hamiltonian dynamics, because the Hamiltonian sort of has to be time invariant just by the way you write it down. But like, it seems like with a, as long as you had like a time asymmetric Lagrangian, it seems like you, like why couldn't you still, why still couldn't you
go with? I didn't say it, or I may have said it, I probably didn't say it, but when we're talking about Lagrangians, we're talking about conservative forces implicitly. And it's somewhat circular logic, because a conservative force is something that is defined as something that's described by a dimension. What you can, what I'll challenge you to do is try and write down the term in the action that would describe a frictional force, say, that depends just on linearly on the velocity. And what you'll find is it doesn't quite work. Okay. So that was classical mechanics in a nutshell. I also thought that it would be useful to talk about central force motion. And since this is a force in gravity, an excellent example is provided then by Newtonian gravity. So,
well, we can write down a force law. So that would be gm1, m2 over r1 minus. So what I have in mind then is I've got two masses at position R1, R2. This is the, as I've written it, well, I haven't told you what the vector is yet. This is a unit vector that's pointing from 2 to 1. So here is R1 minus R2. But I need a unit vector this to tell me which way the force is pointing. And so there's a rho hat 1, 2, which is just this separation, or this R1 minus R2 over the magnitude. So this is the force on mass 1 due to mass 2. It's got this minus sign in there. So even though the unit vector is pointing that way, the force is an attractive force. And of course, it's going like the separation between those two particles squared. And then I need a conversion constant to get all of this stuff, or the units of this stuff here, to agree with the units of the force. And so this is, of course, Newton's constant. So, and to get the units right, well, the simplest way to write it is in terms of Newton meter squared over kilogram squared. So Newton's constant is just something that we, well, it's experimentally measured, but we can think of it as a conversion constant that makes that equation make sense. If I had a bunch of other particles here, so this was M2, M3, M4, this is my M1. I could just superimpose
total force here is just the sum. As we were discussing here, the important thing about that force law is that there's a potential. And so I can write a potential U12, which is and then my force is just the gradient of that potential, or minus the gradient. So there's a gradient where I'm acting on the, for F12, I'm going to be acting on the X1 coordinates that are buried in there. And this linear superposition comes if I say that the total potential energy associated with particle 1 is again just the sum of the potentials U1k with all of, well, written in the same way, replacing twos by k's. So we had this framework of Lagrangian mechanics. Typically, what we do, though, is rather than studying arbitrary masses, we think about the solar system, where one of the masses, say, is the mass of the sun, which is huge. The other mass is the mass of the Earth, which is some six orders of magnitude smaller than that. And so what we describe is the motion of the Earth around the sun. If we start with that over there, what one would do is divide the problem into the center of mass motion . This is really the motion of the sun, so EG, the motion of the sun, and the relative motion. The motion of the Earth around the sun. So we have our Lagrangian that we're supposed to write down. This is, if, say, I have M2 as the sun, I'm going to set it to rest, and this particle is moving around it. The force is a radial force, and so it's appropriate to use, or the nicest set of coordinates to use, is spherical polar coordinates. So some set of coordinates like this. When I write out my Lagrangian, then kinetic energy takes that form, and the potential was there. So it had a minus sign in it. It just becomes then minus, or plus rather, gm, the little mass, over r. I don't know if it was a jump,
but you can, we're going to figure out where that kinetic energy came from. It's just, I'm just converting the usual x dot y dot, or x dot squared plus y dot squared plus z dot squared into that spherical polar coordinates. If I look at the equations, the simplest equation to look at is, first of all, to look at the phi equation, because there are no phis anywhere in the problem. There's no phi in the potential. There's no theta in the potential either, but the theta appears here in the kinetic term. So let's start with phi. What I told you was that the conjugate momentum was conserved. So delta L, delta phi dot, which is just going to be this, well, the variation of this term. I'm going to have m r squared sine squared theta phi dot is some constant. It's a constant that, of course, we're familiar with. It's the z component, well, with these coordinates here. It's the component of the angular momentum around the z-axis. The potential only depends on r. And so let's look at the theta equation next. What did we write? So on this side of the equation, I have d by dt of mr squared theta dot on this side of the equation, I'm still picking up this term here. And so there's an m r squared sine theta cos theta phi dot squared. So that's rather annoying. There's this term that's telling us that the conjugate momentum is not conserved. On the other hand, in the spirit of coordinates are our friends, one of the things we can notice is if I pick theta equals pi by 2, which means that I'm moving it, that sets this term to 0, and I'm moving in the xy plane, that sets this side of the equation again, pi by 2 sine theta equals 0, then it's consistent to set theta dot equals 0, i.e., that if I start the motion in the xy plane, it just stays there. So now, that may seem like a special set of motions to be describing, but the point is that any motion is going to be planar. And so if I'm considering the orbit of the Earth around the sun, what we're going to do is we're going to set up our coordinate system so that that orbit lies in the xy plane. You could just as easily set that up so that the orbit moves in the xz plane. It's just that that would be a lot more work. Actually, it wouldn't be that much. Well, this is the most natural way to set up the problem. And so we're just going to use our freedom to choose our coordinate system in that way. So the motion is always motion in a plane. And so that's going to make life simpler for us. Now, in fact, LZ is not just the z component of the angular momentum, the other components of the angular momentum are equal to zero, and so Lz becomes the total angular momentum. And it simplifies in this way because we don't have to worry about our sines and cosines anymore. The sines are just equal to one. Or alternatively, I can write that as phi dot is equal to L over MR squared. Of course, the most interesting equation is the radial motion because that's where the potential plays a role. And I'll squeeze it in at the top. And what do we have here? So this term here gives us an MR double dot is equal to, well, there would be a term here, MR theta dot squared, but because of the choice we made here, that term, we're throwing it away. Similarly, this term gives us an MR MR sine squared theta phi dot squared. Again, we're in the plane, so our sine is just one. And then this term gives us the gravitational force. This term was zero. That one we can simplify because what we have is this nice equation saying that phi dot is given by the angular momentum divided by mr squared. And so at the end of the day, what we end up with is L squared over MR squared minus GMM over R squared. So I can think of this, well, here's my gravitational force. I might think of that as some centrifugal force or some effective force. That's coming because of the angular momentum or the angular motion of the particle. Sorry? Yes, it is. An astute observer. Thank you. So this is Newton's second law. It's also a second order equation. It's got an R dot, R double dot there. But of course, it's always easier to reduce the number of derivatives. And we can do that by, rather than thinking about the second law, we can think about the fact that the energy is conserved. In that case, then what we had, well, it goes without saying that our Lagrangian had no explicit time dependence in it. There weren't any coefficients that depended on time. So this quantity is conserved. And so what we have there is the kinetic energy. So there's the radial motion. Again, I'm going to throw away the theta motion because we've chosen to put the orbit in the xy plane. The phi contribution simplifies in that way. And then we had minus gm m over r. And I'll make the same substitution for phi dot that we did before. We get angular momentum squared over 2mr squared minus gm over r. So in thinking about that problem now, well, ultimately what we'd like to do, so this is some constant, the energy, what we'd like to do is we'd like to solve for the trajectory. It's a, it would end up being a first order differential equation in terms of simply r. But I can think of it as a single particle moving, or a particle moving in a single dimension, where I've got the energy, the standard kinetic energy here, and then this is an effective potential. So so you, one gains a lot of intuition for the behavior here just by drawing the effective potential and thinking about this effective radial motion or effective problem in the R motion. So there are two contributions. The first is the minus GM over R. So this is, it's got a minus sign. It's going like 1 over R. And then there's a positive contribution, a repulsive contribution, positive. So what dominates asymptotically, although it didn't appear so in my drawing, is the 1 over the one over r is the dominant term. So the effective potential is negative. But eventually, at a small enough radius, this repulsive term kicks in, and we end up like that. So here our attractive force dominates at large R. Here the repulsive core or repulsive and so we basically well we can remind ourselves of the details of the orbits, but we can basically see that there's several different regimes. Again, we have V, we have R, we had an effective potential that was doing this. If the energy is positive, what that means is the motion will be that the particle starts out at infinity, comes in, bounces off the repulsive core, and then goes out to infinity. So that's an unbound orbit. And in fact, the trajectory is a hyperbola in the xy plane. A special case that's again unbound is E equals 0. And then there's the bound orbits for E less than 0. There's a minimum to the potential. So V can't become arbitrary, or
E, I can't set it to be arbitrarily negative. It has to be in this range between V min and zero. And in that case, I get bound orbits. And those are, of course, elliptic. Of course, the special case being if I'm sitting right down here at the bottom, then there's no radial motion, circular. And if I tried to set E less than V min, there's no consistent solution. Of course, I've assumed that we've studied the details of actually solving for the trajectories, but that comes relatively straightforward. We have two equations, R dot and we already wrote phi dot is L over 2mr squared. And so given these equations, I can solve for RFI. And in fact, in the problem set, I invite you to remind yourself how that goes and what the solution actually is. So those, well, those are the technical details. Some comments about this result. One is, this is physics. It's an incredibly, what I talked about was describing the motion of the Earth, but it's a framework that gives us an incredibly accurate description of the motion of all of the planets around the sun. In particular, back in the 1800s, well, I have 1846, using Newtonian gravity, it was Neptune was discovered because what the astronomers saw were irregularities in the orbits of the next planet in Uranus. And those discrepancies were predicted or could be resolved by introducing another massive body orbiting far out from the sun. And so they went and they looked for it, and sure enough, there was a discovery here. However, Mercury also showed similar discrepancies. And I have to emphasize that those discrepancies meant that the position of Mercury in its orbit was off by some 43 arc seconds per century. And that was thought to be a problem. It was thought to be a failure. There were a lot of attempts to describe or to do a similar exercise to resolve those discrepancies by introducing an extra mass, an extra dark planet that orbited inside the orbit of Mercury. That planet was never discovered, of course. And eventually, the discrepancy there became one of the classic tests of general relativity, which actually was able to resolve that. But again, the thing I wanted to emphasize was that we're talking about missing the position of a planet in its orbit by 43 seconds per century. And that's the accuracy with which astronomers thought they could do physics with this set of laws. The second comment here, or I guess it's disappeared. No, well, here I've got action at a distance. I don't
if I place particle one here, it instantaneously feels a force due to this particle an arbitrary distance away. That's going to lead to problems when we think about special relativity, because there shouldn't be an instantaneous force law like that. The force it feels here could only be, or should only be, the forces it feels here should only depend on information or effects that could have traveled this distance in some interval of time. Yeah.
Access. What sort of in like a pre-relativistic framework, is what was people's objection to like extended
equivalence? Sorry?
In a pre, you know, special relativity framework, what was people's, because I know like you, for example, was uncomfortable with extended distance, but like why did people object to it? If you know if there's
a so before special relativity, why did people object to it?
Right. If there's no limit on the speed of information transfer.
Well, the bottom line was they didn't object with it. I mean, they worked very hard. I mean, it became an objection, perhaps, at some philosophical level. Perhaps they felt comfortable with action at a distance. But at a practical level, what people found is that this was a law of physics that worked extremely well. And so it was accepted as the way nature worked.
Even when Mercury's orbit,
well, I believe it's true. Even when Mercury's orbit, didn't quite match up in the way that I described, they worked extremely hard to work or to use this framework. They didn't automatically say, "Oh, well, we have to write down a new gravitational force law because there's a discrepancy."
So the second one was action at a distance. So eventually this is problem or creates a problem for special relativity.
I was confused because I thought you were describing problems people had discovered with Newtonian gravity. I didn't realize it was just
This was a statement the theory works extremely well. Yeah. This was a success. This is a prelude, though. You know, tomorrow we're going to start talking about special relativity, and so there is going to be a tension here. And in fact, resolving that tension was one of the thought experiment. Is one of the first indications of how general relativity arises. Another comment, and this is just a third random
comment, is that there, we can think in terms of a potential field. And so here the analogy is with electromagnetism or electrostatics. So if I just write phi of x, all I'm doing is I'm taking the potential felt by the particle of interest due to all of the other particles, and I'm going to divide by the charge, which is dividing by the mass. And now I'm left with a potential field, which was the sum over all of these potentials, but it includes the mass, or it just has the mass of all of the other particles. Or I might imagine writing this in some integral for a density.
Well,
So here, I'm not going to include the sum, or I'm not going to include 1 in that.
Right. Term. What's the symbol of M on?
On in the numerator.
Oh, OK. K, sorry.
Ah.
Nope, my fault. So if I had some distribution of masses, I could think that I'm going to integrate. So if I wanted to find the gravitational field for an Earth that has a varying density profile, I could do an integral like this to find the potential either inside the Earth or outside. In keeping with the analogy, the equation that I would write here, or I could write a differential equation which this potential satisfies, so that would be Laplacian acting on my potential. I have to stick a 4 pi in there. There's my g, and then the mass density everywhere. So this is just the in the same way that this I'm building on an analog here in electromag or in electrostatics. This was just Gauss's law, where this was the electromagnetic potential or the electrostatic potential, and this was the charge density. Now it's the mass density. And again, alluding back to these problems, what Maxwell found was that Gauss's law had to be supplemented in various ways, or in a certain specific way, to be consistent with special relativity. At the end of the day, this is an approximate equation, but we'll find that in regimes where special relativity plays a role, this equation isn't quite right and gets supplemented in the same way, in basically the same way that we fix Gauss's law in electromagnetism. So I will pause there, because then I start talking about some other ideas. Are there any questions?
We're all happy with each other. So where we're going next is still a review. Well, I'm still thinking of it, but it's a review. We're going to start talking about special relativity. Although we're not quite going to talk about it yet, all I want to say is that when we get to special relativity, one of the things that happens is the language changes, as well as the physics changes. But there are some new ideas that enter into our vocabulary, one of them being space-time, another being a principle of relativity. New words or new ideas. So to what extent are they new? Well, in classical mechanics, we don't have a space-time. What we have is space. And that space is just described by essentially the flat Cartesian coordinates, or the Cartesian coordinates that I had before,
It's something that I measure with rulers or meter sticks. And this is really the stage in which our physics takes place. It's the place where our particles move around. And then there's another separate, time is a separate concept. And it's also absolute. Everybody's clocks, well, it's measured with clocks or watches, and everybody's clocks and watches work in the same way, and there's simply no mixing between these two. So that's just for the contrast. Now, what about this principle of relativity? The closest thing that we have to a principle of relativity was something that I implicitly was saying over and over again. And that was the idea that I had some set of physical laws, or I had some interesting Lagrangian, but I could use any old coordinate system that I wanted. I could set it up in any way that made the problem simple to solve, and that wasn't changing the physics. So the closest thing that we have to this principle is that the implicit idea that I can set up any old coordinate system, we can use any set of coordinates, to describe the same physics. And we can make that a little more precise in the same, well, in the vein that we'll see. Namely, if I write so if we write Newton's second law, F equals ma, so implicitly when I'm writing a formula like dt squared of a vector x, I'm thinking that I'm working in Cartesian coordinates, but I'm not telling you which Cartesian coordinate system I'm using. And so that physical law takes the same form, or our principle here will be that physical law takes the same form in any Cartesian coordinate system that are related by in a particular set of ways. So So the first thing that I'm free to do with my coordinate system is the thing that we did in discussing the central force motion, What I said is the simplest way to set up the problem was to put the motion in the xy plane. So implicitly, if I had an arbitrary orbit that I was thinking about, what I did is I rotated my coordinate system so that that motion lay in the xy plane. So I can relate, or if I relate two coordinate systems with a rotation, that doesn't change the form of my physical law. So I could write, I guess I'll write that, x prime. If I'm doing a rotation around the x-axis, so doing a simple rotation like that doesn't change this equation that I'm writing down there. Of course, the other thing perhaps that was implicit in the way we did the problem was that we said that the sun was sitting at the origin. So implicitly what I did is if I saw my solar system sitting over there, I moved my coordinate system and I oriented it so that the origin was centered on the sun. So a simple example is if I just move along the y-axis. Again, if I add some arbitrary, if I do some arbitrary or simple shift, this is just a constant there, just as the theta was a constant, my physical law doesn't change. So these are actually just symmetries of that R3 geometry, or the Cartesian, of the space in which we're doing, or in which the particles are moving. The last symmetry that we can do is called a Galilean transform. And that is that this particular physical law doesn't change if I'm studying the physics in a frame where, say, I'm fixed at the center of the galaxy and the sun is orbiting or moving past us, or if I'm in that frame where I'm sitting with the sun or I'm moving with the solar system and moving with a constant velocity. Again, if I add velocities into the game, this equation, which has to do with accelerations, doesn't change. So again, this is going beyond the symmetry of this, the geometry of the space, in that I'm going to mix time into this transformation. So this coordinate system is moving with respect to that one, but it's moving with just a fixed constant velocity. Again, a constant velocity doesn't change that particular law. But this is, in some sense, a reflection of the fact that time is absolute. This isn't, it's mixing t and the spatial coordinates, so it's something different than these first two, which are just symmetries of the space. And so I picked on Newton's second law, but in principle, one might like to think about electrostatics or think about other kinds of physics. And so our principle our classical principle of relativity, and I'll put that in quotes, would be not just that Newton's second law, but that all physical laws should take the same form. And that's
Well, this is something that seems to work as far as the classical mechanic is concerned. And so, again, we use these transformations in a very practical way to set up the problem or whatever problem we're studying to make its solution as simple as possible. However, an issue is that at the end of the day, or at the beginning of the last century, this rule ran into an ugly experimental fact. And that comes by thinking about the consequences here for the addition of velocities. So, if I'm thinking about the velocity in terms of, well, if I want to just think about the addition of velocities, all I'm going to do is I'm going to take the derivative with respect to time on both sides of this equation. And what we have is that vx prime is equal to vx, vz prime is equal to vz, and there's a simple addition that vy prime is the old velocity minus this difference between the two coordinate systems. And again, in most systems, or in many systems that were relevant for classical mechanics, this works. When we're talking about the motion of, cars or sound waves, this is a rule that works, and it works very well. However, what happened at the end of the 1800s is people began to think about the motion of light. And of course, I'll just remind you that in that case, we run into a problem. So the time is 1887. That's the Michelson and Morley experiment. People had thought that light propagated in a medium, the ether. What they did is an experiment to detect the motion of the Earth in the ether. If I think about the Earth going around the solar system, we don't know where the ether is or what the fixed frame where the ether has no velocity is. But over the course of a year, the motion of the Earth is such that it doesn't matter, if I happen to be in the frame where the ether was, or I was moving with the ether here, then at a later time in the year, their experiment must have been moving with respect to that ether. But unfortunately, they found no evidence for and so that gives us a contradiction then with this transform or this addition of velocity laws. And Well, we'll continue next day, but it's the resolution of this contradiction or this problem that leads us then to special relativity. And so that's simply then setting the stage for our discussion of special relativity next day. And so we'll pause again and ask if there are any questions. Dennis has a question.
We had a break for 10 minutes.
Oh, I thought I was done.
You did the morning, sorry.
I have the whole morning. We can do special relativity.
Yeah. Oh, we'll have a short break.
Oh dear. Okay.
You don't have the notes.
What's up to you?
No, I have lots of notes. The problem is I have children at home. Can I make a phone call? Let's take a break and I'll make a phone call. And, okay.